Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history.
Today I've got quite a surprise for you. It's something that I've been talking about for years and years and years. But in actual fact, it's really important, but I've just not gotten around to tackling it until today. And today you're going to see what I uncovered back in 2018. In August of 2018, I had quite a breakthrough. Today you're going to see some of what that breakthrough was about. Some of you will remember that I did the video series, The Great Jewish Mask. And I was reading from a little pamphlet that was published in the United States. And then there were questions. Who wrote this thing? Who was behind it? And what do we know about it? Well, today you're going to see something that I uncovered as a direct result of the Great Jewish Mask. And I'm going to be able to tell you a little bit about the people who were behind it. And the same people who were behind the wonderful little booklet of the Great Jewish Mask, as a unexpected consequence of hunting for that, I actually uncovered the thing that is the main topic of today's video. You're about to see something else that those same people found out. So today it's going to be about the hideous side of Jews, Jews plotting the coming slaughter of white people, but primarily Germans. And you're going to learn a few things about the interactions between whites and Jews back then. So let me tell you what I uncovered about the Great Jewish Mask. The Great Jewish Mask was actually written as a series inside a magazine called The American Gentile. And if you'll look on the screen in front of you, you'll see an actual copy that I got hold of. But to get hold of this copy was quite a story. Anyhow, this particular copy is from February 1936. And you can see on the top there, American Gentile, For God, Home, and Country. A semi-monthly for the defense of Gentile culture and civilization. And there you can see it says, Jewry plots a European war. And that's going to be the big topic for today. But this American Gentile, this thing was really driven by Russians, as best I can tell. So there were two Russians who ended up coming to America, among many. I think lots of them fled to America. And two Russians who lived in Chicago were the prime movers behind the magazine called American Gentile. These guys also had contacts with Nazis. But both of these guys, the one guy's first name is Peter and the other one's first name is Victor. They were both in the Russian army. Victor was a captain in the Tsar's army. And Peter was a White Guard officer. So I think we can say that these guys were probably, at the very least, middle class, maybe even somewhat slightly upper class Russians. These were really good guys. So, as a small tribute to them, here's a little bit of music from Russia so that you can see the best of white Russia. And then we're going to dive into these guys and what they had to say about Jews. And they were onto Jews big time. And they were desperately trying to help white Americans understand the danger of Jewry. So here's some music, and then we're going to dive into this, and you're in for some surprises. I'm sure you found that as nice as I did. I must admit that one aspect of the Russians that I really appreciate is their kind of stage theatre and their dancing. It's very, very good. And it's so nice and healthy. You see, white men and women being white men and women don't have some trannies or fags or other human trash involved in it. Their theater and their music is absolutely first class. Because Russia is so huge, and Mongols were also involved in that, and Mongols also ruled them for a time, you do have quite a bit of Asiatic stuff as you move further to the east. But there used to be a term, the White Russians, and my understanding is that the term the White Russians is a reference to the Russians who are much more European. So this is an example of the best of Russia, the White Russians, their culture, etc. So let me tell you what I uncovered about the Great Jewish Mosque and the American Gentile. The two guys who were the key people behind the American Gentile were Peter Afanasieff and Victor de Kavel. Peter Afanasieff and Victor de Kavel. And the information I have is that they were the primary figures behind the American Gentile, an anti-Semitic and pro-Nazi publication active in the United States during the 1930s. Both were Russian emigres with military backgrounds. Afanasieff had served as a White Guard officer, while de Kavel, born Victor Levok, was a captain in the Russian Tsarist army. After arriving in the U.S. in the early 1920s, they collaborated to publish The American Gentile, disseminating anti-Jewish and pro-Nazi propaganda, basically the truth. Afanasieff also used aliases such as Prince Peter Kushubi and Peter V. Armstrong. While Afanasieff and de Kavel were central to the publication, they were not the only individuals involved. Afanasieff in particular was associated with Nazi agents like Fritz Gesibel and Oscar Faust, indicating a broader network of collaborators contributing to the newspaper's content and operations. I tried to find photos of these two gentlemen, but I can't find any. I also discovered that Afanasieff was convicted of forging a United States Treasury check and sentenced to 18 months in prison. Maybe he was desperate for money. But the bottom line is that The American Gentile was published in Chicago, Illinois, starting in 1935. So these two guys were basically doing what we are doing on the internet these days, except they had it much harder. So who knows what kinds of problems they had and financial issues they had as they tried to do different things. But the one thing that is very important here is that both of these guys were in the military. I always like military guys giving information. Military guys are closer to the reality of what's going on, and no doubt these guys must have been really heartbroken over what Jewry managed to pull off in Russia. And they wanted to warn Americans. One of the things that I've discovered in some of my readings about the past is that because of all the Jewish nonsense that was going on in Russia, the Jews were basically trying to overthrow Russia for about 100 years. There are aspects of history that I'm not familiar with, and so I'm only now really starting to form opinions about it. But it looks to me as if with the French Revolution and the French Revolution engaging in all kinds of liberation, that the huge problem was when the French and Napoleon let the Jews out of the ghettos. That may be the prime mover in why we today are sitting with this Jewish nightmare globally that we are sitting with. That Jewish nightmare may be the ultimate consequence of letting the Jews out and basically making them equal, letting them out and letting them run amok in Europe. That all the things that we've got that have happened since then is a direct result of letting the Jews go free. But the interesting thing is that the first true victim of this Jewish madness seems to have been Russia. But Jews were also busy with all kinds of other shit as well, hey? After the French Revolution, in the 1840s, there were a bunch of revolutions across Europe. And those revolutions were a kind of mixture of communism and, let's say, liberalism. And there were a bunch of these revolutions in the middle of the 1800s, in the 1840s. So Jewry was very likely already trying to overthrow places then. But in the case of Russia, the Jews worked long and hard to overthrow the Russians. And the Russian Tsars were really the first people to meet up with the hideous evil that we've come to know as Jewry. And interestingly enough, the Tsars tried to get the Germans also to fight against the Jews, specifically at the time of the last Kaiser of Germany in World War I. The Tsar was pushing hard for the stupid Kaiser to also take Jewry seriously. I'm not sure why. I'm not sure if some of it had to do with Jews inside Germany causing problems inside Russia. At that same time, you also had German Jews running amok in South Africa and Southern Africa. They played a big role here. So at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, the Germany of that time was a Germany that's very much like the United States today. The Jews were absolutely at home in Germany. The Jews were busy with all kinds of big projects. They were operating on a big scale, doing many, many things. They were running amok in Europe and in other countries. And those Jews were liaising with Jews in England, Jews in America. Lots of wild shit was going on. But the Kaiser was a moron. Later on, there was talk in the time of Hitler, there was talk of bringing the Kaiser back. My understanding is that Hitler was so disgusted with the Kaiser that he basically thought that the Kaiser was a total idiot when it came to Jewry, and Hitler would have none of that. So Hitler basically thought the Kaiser was an idiot. He basically had a problem with the Kaiser in the same way that he had a problem with Mussolini, that Mussolini just couldn't understand the Jews. Mussolini may even have brought something like 700,000 Jews into Italy. And Hitler struggled like hell to try and get Mussolini to understand that race is a biological thing. And Mussolini just could never get that. And I think the Kaiser is in the same kind of class. Maybe even worse than Mussolini. Just a total bozo who just can't understand that you've got different kinds of humans. They will act differently. End of story. That's what Hitler's trying to tell them. They just can't grasp this. That if you got Jews, it's like if you put rats in a certain place, the rats are going to behave in a certain way. You're going to have trouble. You're going to have certain problems that come from it. That's how it's going to be, man. Hitler's just trying to get people to understand that the behavior of humans is determined by biology, period. That you can't get away from this thing, and nobody is able to grasp that. And people think in terms of religion and culture and all kinds of other junk, which Jewry, of course, goes on to encourage. because then they're home free. They can do what they want to. Anyway, returning to Peter and Victor, the guys who were the prime movers behind the American Gentile and the Great Jewish Mosque. Let me just give a very teeny weeny summary of the Great Jewish Mosque, because this has a big bearing on racial issues. In the Great Jewish Mosque, those Russians tell us that the Jews are nothing like they claim to be, that how we view Jewry is actually a carefully crafted propaganda campaign. And keep in mind, back in those days, right up until the time of Hitler and Hitler's time ruling Germany, that all white people took Christianity extremely seriously. Virtually everyone was a Christian, and they took Christianity extremely seriously. So the Jews were then playing to this business, we're the people of the Bible, we're God's chosen, we are these wonderful people as portrayed in the Bible, blah, 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 blah. But meanwhile, they are nothing of the sort. And these guys were telling us that in actual fact, what Jews appear to be versus what they really are, they are basically like an ass, a donkey that's taken on or covered himself in the skin of a lion. So you've basically got a donkey that pretends to be a lion. And that's the real thing here, that these Jews are nothing like they claim to be. And I must tell you that that is still true to this day. Jews try to pretend to be cleverer, better, etc., than they really are. And if you look carefully, as you will see today, and on other occasions, I will point this out again, you will see that Jews make mistakes. Jews do wrong things. And whites catch them out. In the same way that we're catching Jews out today, in 2025, people were catching Jews out in the 1920s and even earlier. And when we look at some of the things the Jews were doing in the past, that is well documented, it will also give us good insights into things the Jews have to be doing behind the scenes now. It'll give you a better feel for how Jews really function behind the scenes. You will see more of this in other videos that I've got planned for the near future. So let me tell you what I uncovered in more detail. What I was trying to do back in 2018, I was trying to find in which publications did this Great Jewish Mosque come from. And it was while I was busy with that, that I eventually found copies of this magazine. But these copies were not even in America. I had to buy these copies from a library in a small Western nation, and that is where I got these images from. I had to pay the library to scan various images so that I could get the proofs that I wanted. And indeed, I saw the Great Jewish Mosque in parts in this magazine. But while I was looking through the stuff that they were sending me, I spotted this thing, which blew my flipping mind. The thing that you see on the screen in front of you, where it says, Jewry plots a European war. The writing may be too small for you to see, but above that, it actually tells you the volume and the date. So it's volume 1, it's February 1936, and it's number 13. So this thing has been running for a year, and this is the first one of 1936. So at this point in time, Hitler has been the Chancellor of Germany for 3 years. This is his third year. So war hasn't broken out yet. There hasn't been a single shot fired yet. But Jewry is busy plotting a European war. And when you get into this, you will see that Jewry as a whole have got goals, and Jews are working together to make their hideous goals come true. But as you look around, you will realize later that there are many times when Jews seem to know the future, where whites catch Jews out and they realize where Jewry is taking us. In the same way that we have seen in modern times all the hideous, nefarious racial things that Jews have been plotting. Now, years later, the Jews later lie and pretend that no, they weren't plotting anything. They weren't involved in a conspiracy. They weren't up to anything evil. That's just a bunch of right-wing rubbish. But I'm going to show you this and other examples where you'll see clearly that Jewry gets caught out every now and then, and whites see very clearly what these rotten Jews are actually up to and how hideous it is for us. So I got to tell you, if it wasn't for the work of those two Russian military officers, we would not be seeing something like this. Thank goodness for the work that they did. Sadly, I don't know anything more about what happened in their lives, what went on with them. I will do a bit more digging. Before we dive into the article about Jews plotting a war, I thought that this drawing that they had there was really, really important. And this drawing says, the price of tolerance. The price of tolerance. Let me tell you something about Jews and other races. Because our race is so powerful and we are so dominant, and we have conquered countries, we've conquered huge chunks of land outside of Europe, and we've conquered areas and defeated other races. And then when those races are broken and they are under our control and we're the boss, that we tend to forget that those people living inside our civilization, like blacks in Africa living under white rule, blacks and Indians in North America living under white rule of the Canadians and the Americans and so forth, that something that we don't understand is that because we are so powerful and our civilization is so powerful, that when we've conquered them, they have no choice but to work with us, because anything they do by themselves isn't going to amount to much. And the same is true for Jewry. Jewry knows that if they go off and do something, they're not going to get very far. And Jewry has realized that its best days are when it functions inside our civilization. So returning to the concept of the Jewish mosque, where these guys talk about the image that Jews like to project about themselves versus the rubbish that they really are. So they put on a mask, and that mask is to fool us. Now let me tell you that other races do the same. They're just not as practiced as the Jews, but other races do the same thing. Take for example, Rhodesia, the happy blacks. The happiest blacks in Africa are these blacks who live in Rhodesia. We look after them so well, they are so happy to work with us. And what happens? The moment that they find that they can gain power and they can break free, they will. Then all of a sudden, when they see that they can get the upper hand on us, they go for it. All of a sudden, those friendly blacks are busy murdering your people and fighting you and trying to destroy your society as they try to gain power. Remember Nietzsche and the will to power. All biological entities seek power. So when white Americans are looking at America and saying, oh, well, we got Indians here, we got blacks here, we got Jews here, and they're all living under our system and they're all happy, you are basically walking into the same old trap that Rhodesians and others have had before. And so you get Americans who say, oh, well, you know, America is so awesome that these blacks and these Jews and and Indians and everybody, they're just loving it here. They are loving America. And it must be our system. That's why they are so happy. But those people may just have a mask on because they know that white America is way more powerful than them. And white America can crush them at any time. And so they put on their smiley face, they do their thing. They know that if they were to go back to Africa, it won't be that good. It's better to put a smiley face on and do as per the rules of white America. So one of the things you need to keep in mind is that when you're the boss, when you have the power, even when you don't even think about it openly, that when your civilization has the power, your race has the power, you've got to realize that those that are weaker than us, they not only put on masks, but they can easily also build up resentment and hatred, but they are too weak to express it. However, if they see a chance one day to break free, they will. Let's say in a hypothetical situation, let's pick a completely hypothetical situation. The Chinese invade Canada or the Chinese invade America and the whites appear to be losing. You might then find that all the non-whites and other trash in your country all of a sudden are happy to switch over to the side of the enemy in the hope that they're going to have a better deal under that enemy of yours than they had with you. They know what they had with you and they are sick and tired of you, and when they see the chance to break free, then they will. They might be right and they'll be able to get free, or they might be wrong and they won't be able to get free and you'll have to punish them. But you need to be aware that other races living with you, under you, will not share your view of your country the way you do. America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, all of these are just successful European colonies. You could argue that Russia is also just a successful European colony. These are whites. Americans and Russians and Canadians are basically whites who've left Europe and gone to another place and conquered and succeeded. And now you've got all these other hangers on from the people that you defeated. But you mustn't think that those people are going to be as loyal to you as you are to your own system. So keep this concept of the mask in mind, that a lot of the things that you see with Jews are simply the result of Jews spending a very long time with us. I raised this in that video where I discussed about Jews and evolution and why they are dangerous. They are dangerous because they've been coexisting with us for so long. And the same nonsense that they come up with, you're gonna see blacks and others doing the same thing. They might not be as clever and as devious and as practiced as Jews, but the others will do the same. You must never imagine, and I can see that lots of white Americans are fooled by this. They think that black Americans have got the same level of loyalty to America as white Americans. I'm telling you, if the Chinese or let's say the Mexicans or Latinos managed to figure out something, if somebody else was going to come into North America, you are going to be shocked at how these other people are going to turn against you. But you have already seen indications of it with regard to Jews inside America working on blacks and turning blacks against the system, getting blacks worked up, getting blacks to start setting things on fire, getting blacks to engage in communism, getting blacks to engage in violence. The Jews know, here we are in America, and look, there are some black people there. We could work on those black people and turn them against the whites. And so jury is in there, in the same way that they did it in Southern Africa, especially South Africa. So you've got these humans that we've conquered, that our ancestors conquered. And now these humans, when they see someone might conquer us, then they will be among the first to switch sides. And they also aren't that loyal to your system. And if they see your system is going down, they'll start changing. Jury is just way more practiced at this than everybody else. Jews have done these things not just dozens of times, possibly hundreds of times. So keep in mind the concept that just because Jews have invented a mask doesn't mean that others don't have masks either. In the end, white Americans, you're on your own. You are the only people that really matter when it comes to defending the USA. You and any other whites who dive in with you. And it's the same for whites everywhere. We at least feel proud of our civilization, and we know the value of our civilization, and we know the value of other white nations. Those of us who are here in the white right. So we know that other white countries are important. But I'm warning you, don't imagine that your blacks are any better than the blacks of South Africa or anyone else. All of these races, they are conquered people. They will turn on you. So I enjoyed this image that they had in the American Gentile, and this image, which is titled The Price of Tolerance. So there you can see the Jew looking all Asiatic, and on the back of the Jew, this is 1934, hey? So take a look at this. There's some interesting symbols here. You've got the hammer and sickle on the back of this Jew, the hammer and sickle from Bolshevism. There you've got the symbol that would later be associated with Israel. And then you see another one. This other one fascinates me. That dark one that's like a five-sided star. I'm sure that that is a five-sided red star. The guys from the Great Jewish Mosque, these Russians, they spoke about this thing. And this five-sided red star is something you'll see in other places. Keep an eye open for it whenever you find newspapers that have got names like the star, because it may be that star. Anyway, to the right of him, you see the Talmud, you see the protocols of the elders of Zion, and there you can see what I assume is the woman from the Statue of Liberty, maybe tied up to the so-called Star of David or whatever the rubbish is called. And here is the Jew ready to beat her with this whip. And it looks to me like what they would call a cat o' nine tails. This is the kind of whip that they used to use in the British Navy to beat sailors with. So this is a cat o' nine tails. And if you look at the nine tails, you'll see bottom of it, it says press control. Then it says fake pacifism, slave labor, money control, wars, revolutions. Then it's got socialism and atheism, both of which I don't have a problem with. But in their case, it's more like the socialism from communism, because communists refer to their system as socialist. But their socialism is not the same as Hitler's socialism. Two completely different things. But in the Christianity of the time, they saw atheism as a big negative. But anyway, Bolshevism. So the price of tolerance, you have the Jews constantly beating you with all these other things. That there's a price that you pay. There's a price that you pay for dealing with them. And then it's got a quote on the bottom from a Jew in New York, and it says, "We come to the nations pretending to escape persecution. We, the most deadly persecutors in all the wretched annals of men." The Jew Samuel Roth in New York, 1934. And I should put a bit more context into this, where he says, "We come to the nations pretending to escape persecution." In the 1930s, due to Hitler's activities already, Jews were starting to flee from Germany and from Europe. So Jews were already on the run. They were on the run long before World War II actually even started. It's a topic we're going to come back to shortly. And so the Jews are running around. The Jews are running to other countries, in this case to America. And they are like, oh, we need to get away from our persecutors. Meanwhile, we are the nastiest persecutors of the lot. So a rare instance of a Jew telling the truth. But I thought one could expand on this prize of tolerism nowadays, because you've got pedophilia, transgender, feminism, and all these other rotten rubbish things. That is what comes from tolerance. And white Americans are going to be pushed to the edge. White Americans are going to be pushed to the edge of the edge, where they won't be able to take it anymore. But I thought that was a brilliant drawing, that, and everything in it so true. Okay, so let's read the story of the Jews and the Freemasons and the plot to start a war at the soonest against Germany. The page that I'm reading from is in front of you. These are the instructions which, according to the Belgian paper Renovation of November 2, 1935, the Grand Supreme Council of International Masonry of New York, Grand Orient, has issued to its subordinate lodges in all countries the World Service Information Bulletin of Erfurt, Germany, makes the following comment on this statement. Although we are not in a position to supply legal proof of the correctness of the above revelation, and that revelation being that Jewry is plotting a European war, we nevertheless cannot alone bear the responsibility for the knowledge of such an atrocity. We therefore consider it our duty to pass on the revelation of the Renovation, that is the newspaper, to responsible statesmen, parliamentarians, and politicians in all countries, to enable them to ward off in good time the dangers which may be threatening. This is really awesome. These people are actually trying to prevent a world war. And this information has originally come from a Belgian newspaper. So let's continue. We also regarded it as our duty to follow back the traces of this sensational revelation. In fact, one of our collaborators even had the opportunity to confer with the author of this news. He informed us as follows. Mr. Terve, T-E-R-F-V-E, the informant of Renovation, is a Freemason of the 33rd degree and lives in Antwerp. Some time ago, his lodge put him to sleep, that's in inverted commas. That is to say, they shelved him because he had joined the Belgian national movement, the Realists, led by Armand Janssens, editor of the Renovation, and in spite of the demands of his lodge, had not left it. So he basically did something that the lodge didn't want him to do. And then in the end, he ends up telling this newspaper an inside story from the lodge. So let's continue. I have seen this communication of the lodge in the original. It was signed by, it's hard to read this, but it's like Mixraim Masons. It's spelled M-I-X-R-A-I-M Masons. Of the 95th, 97th, and 99th degrees. So this guy got a communication from the lodge, and he actually showed it. He showed it to someone, I'm not sure exactly who, whether it's the person who runs this Realists movement or the Renovation, but he received this communication from the Masons that he belongs to, and they actually saw the communication and it was signed by what appeared to be extremely high-ranking Masons. Now, I've gone and checked up because I've only ever heard of 33 degrees in Freemasonry. I've never heard of higher levels. And even when I go and I dug around, the highest I've seen in Freemasonry is 33 degrees. This is the first time ever that I've heard of 95, 97, and even 99 degrees. So I'm not sure if 99 degrees is as high as it goes, or whether it goes even higher. That is quite wild. I've never heard of anything like that. But this is definitely an extremely high-ranking communication. Now listen to this, because this is really fascinating. In the Great Jewish Mosque, they mentioned briefly that Jews may have bought out all the Freemason lodges in the late 1800s. But in this article, they actually tell you more detail. Listen to this. In 1874, stated Turf, an agreement was made between the B'nai B'rith Order. B'nai B'rith, you've heard them many times, eh? B'nai B'rith played a role in catching Alfred Schaefer and sending him to jail. B'nai B'rith played a role in South Africa in bribing the last president of South Africa. So it says, in 1874, stated Turf, an agreement was made between the B'nai B'rith Order and World Freemasonry, by which the lodges were handed over entirely to the Jews. So the Jews bought out the world's Freemason lodges in 1874. In the upper degrees, he stated, it is believed that over all lodges there stands a small group of Jews, the so-called dirigeants occults, who are the real leaders of World Freemasonry. Let me just pause there. I have spoken to other people who know their history about our race, like Dr. Mike Dutoy here in South Africa. And he said to me that Freemasonry in its early days was a good thing. It was intended to basically allow Masons to keep their trade secrets. And Hitler's hero, King Frederick the Great, allowed Freemasonry into Prussia, and he himself joined it. And lots of the American founding fathers were Freemasons. But you've got to remember that prior to 1874, Freemasonry was under white control. So it was probably a good thing until 1874, until Jewry gets their filthy hands on Freemasonry. Let's continue. Concerning the World War Command, and that's how it's written here in 1936 in inverted commas, World War Command of the Grand Supreme Council de New York. Turv reports that Freemasonry acts with extreme caution in such important matters by which it might easily compromise itself. No proceedings of such secret sessions are taken, and nothing is put down in writing. Let me just pause there. Here you are seeing some good secrecy practice by the Freemasons. Something well worth taking note of. So it says, no proceedings of such secret sessions are taken, and nothing is put down in writing. So when they have secret sessions, they don't write any minutes of what was said. There are no records of what was said. So it continues, it says, no definite decisions are, and let's jump to the next page. No definite decisions are arrived at or resolutions passed in the usual meaning of the term. It is so arranged that at the end of a meeting, a previously determined high-grade brother gives a short account of what has been discussed, from which the lines of procedure and instructions for Freemasons can be gathered indirectly but unmistakably. So let's just look at that again. What they're basically saying is that they don't take any minutes down. Nothing is written down. Then a predetermined guy will sum up at the end of it in a short way what has been discussed and the instructions for the Freemasons. And it says, from which the lines of procedure and instructions for Freemasons can be gathered indirectly but unmistakably. It's basically as if he speaks in something of a diplomatic code. He speaks in a certain way and he summarizes the key issues and what must be taken away from this. It continues, Mr. Turv then reported that a high-grade Mason with whom he is acquainted took part at a meeting of the high grades at which the instructions of the Grand Supreme Council de New York were given out. However, now listen to this, the command was, in typical Freemasonic manner, couched in such moderated phrases as, it would be desirable that, ... it would be in the interests of humanity, ... etc. This form of expression is current in Freemasonry, as it leaves a loophole for escape and facilitates the giving of oaths before court. From this it can be seen how difficult it is to prove anything against Freemasonry in court. Their Talmudic expressions always make it possible for the Lodge brothers to affirm that something else was meant, and so on. For the Masons themselves, who are accustomed to this form of expression, the instruction is absolutely unequivocal and binding. This is obvious from the fact that the Grand Supreme Conseil du Grand Orient de Belgique, that's Belgium, has declared the resolution binding for itself. Turv will not, for obvious reasons, reveal the name of the high-grade brother who took part at the meeting in question. He, however, guarantees fully the validity of the statement. So let me just pause there because this is a really fascinating thing. We get a really good insight into the inner workings of the Freemasonry at that time, and probably a lot of this still functions like that now. So basically, these Freemasons talk to each other in this way and they are trained in this form of communication. And there's much to be said for this kind of communication if you are dealing with secret stuff and if it's important stuff that could land you in hot water. So they don't give direct instructions. They don't say like, Fred, you must go and do that. It doesn't work like that. The guy just gives a general statement and he says, it would be in the interests of humanity that, you know, a war against Germany would be better for, you know, humanity or whatever. So they talk in this kind of form and probably they wouldn't even say the word war. And when they say these things, despite these sort of soft phrases and semi-code words, these statements are binding on the Freemasons and a Freemason has to execute it. That's what it looks like to me. But the way it is phrased, if a Freemason is dragged into court, it is done in such a way that there could be ways out of it, that it is so general or it's got multiple angles that you can play with. And so even if he swears to tell the truth on an oath in court, they will struggle to be able to catch him out. I must say, it sounds kind of Jewy to me. It sounds really kind of Jewy to me. But it's fascinating what this 33-degree Freemason, Mr. Turv, has told this Belgian newspaper. Let's continue. So far, the report of our collaborator, we add the following. We have lately received, entirely independently of the Belgian revelation, various reports from World Service friends in England, France, Czechoslovakia. In these reports, the fear based on press utterances and conversations with personalities in political and economic spheres in the various countries is given unanimous expression that Jewry and Freemasonry controlled by it intend to loosen another war upon the world in 1936. So let me just reread that sentence. Is given unanimous expression that Jewry and Freemasonry controlled by it intend to loosen another war upon the world in 1936. So the messages come not just from Belgium, but from others in England, France, and Czechoslovakia, that Jewry is getting ready to try and have Germany destroyed as early as 1936. And remember, the original article was written in November 1935. However, let Freemasonry and the Jews who control it understand that the Aryan nations will not join in a new massacre in which they would bleed one another to death. So these good guys are saying, we Aryans, we whites, we're not going to fall for this Jewish trick. However, as you know, the world did. It just took a little bit longer. We apply to all responsible persons in governments, parliaments, and parties to give their assistance and test the revelation of renovation for accuracy, and if necessary, to bring the intrigues of supranational powers to the light of publicity, thereby rendering humanity a service. But the bummer is that despite Renovation publishing this, despite these guys publishing this, that the vast majority of the world media does not publish this, of course. Jewry, I'm sure, stops all of that. And so the number of people who know about this drive for world war, maybe there are a couple of important people who know, but clearly it's not enough to get out and to warn everyone and people expose the rotten Jews for what they are. Let's continue. The Jewish Masonic drive to bring about a European war is in full swing. The, and it's Jewish World Empire in capitals, the Jewish World Empire makes desperate efforts to impose upon the nations the policy of encircling Germany and Italy in an iron ring. The nationalistic fascist states, which revolted against the Jewish world control, have to be destroyed. Judah never pardons interference with their plans. Germany, and to a lesser extent Italy, have thrown a monkey wrench into Jewish machinery for fulfillment of the protocol program. They have to be destroyed. The drooling Kahila lips of the world Jewish leadership are clamoring for revenge. I think Kahila is supposed to be another level, a very high level of Jews in the world. So here these Russians are telling you a whole bunch of stuff that, you know, Jews have ordered Freemasons. It's time for a world war. We need to destroy Germany and Italy. What I particularly find interesting is the statement that the Jewish World Empire makes efforts to impose upon the nations the policy of encircling Germany and Italy in an iron ring. That is something that I noticed about World War II, at the beginning of World War II. At the beginning of World War II, you see weird things happening, like the Russians invading Finland, and you see the British trying to seize Norway and Sweden. That is very interesting. This is very predictive. This is telling you stuff that is still going to happen within a couple of years. And of course, within just over 3 years, there's going to be Hitler invading Poland because of the more than 50,000 Germans that are being slaughtered in Poland. And Jury probably organized that as well. So this was the next column. Let me get to the last column. So here is the third and the last column. So it's got a bunch of different quotes and things on it. And it says, I apply all my efforts to prevent Europe from being thrown into this criminal adventure in which I am forced by a blind fanaticism allied with nefarious lust. And then in big capital letters it says, but the states as well as the crown of England are not any more the masters of their destiny. Powers beyond our control in my country and elsewhere force into play particular interests and alien idealism. Misery, misfortune to him who provoke the war. I am afraid that my efforts will be smashed against that dark will that urges me to precipitate it, the war. And it says, retranslated from French. Then the next says, the same international Jewish Masonic power is pushing our Jew-controlled Roosevelt Frankfurter administration to pass the hypocritical neutrality bill, vesting upon the president the dictatorial power to provoke a war at the moment favorable to international Jewry. Judge John Bassett Moore, an outstanding authority on the international law, declared before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the intention of this bill is neutrality, which is not neutrality at all, but is a tricky, double-faced contrivance designed to enable a government, while professing to be neutral, to commit unneutral acts under the pretense of promoting peace. Suicidal mania, the execution of which rests exclusively in foreign hands, a subterranean subversive wire pulling by the bloody Judah's hands can be clearly seen in this bill. So basically what that section is saying is that we know that Roosevelt was totally surrounded by lots of communist Jews. And obviously it's no accident. Jews pouring in and Jews literally taking over and playing a huge role in his government. And so they are concocting laws and they are basically getting the Americans to pass laws that sound like they are good. We want neutrality, we want neutrality. But actually, because governments function on strict regulations, the European way is a very legalistic, clear way, okay? But Jury knows how to play tricks. So what they've come up with is, they've come up with this neutrality bill, but the neutrality bill's name versus what it actually does are two different things. And what it actually does is it gives Roosevelt dictatorial powers to do certain things when it suits him and Jury, so that he doesn't have to ask Congress or anyone to do something. The law has been created beforehand so that using the quotes neutrality law, he can do unneutral things. Perhaps this also pertains to the early part of the war, where the American Navy, for example, was literally fighting the German U-boats, and the German U-boats were not allowed to fire back. But basically, the Americans had already given their Navy instructions to destroy German U-boats and German vessels, whereas the Germans had not given their U-boats the right to fight the Americans. So this will give you a bit of an idea of how jury really works with a government. Jews, I know, poured in to be around Roosevelt. And so he's surrounded by lots of Jews, plus those Jews are getting orders from outside. So jury is literally able to put its hand right into the top echelons of power of the United States government for a period of years. And it reaches in, puts its paw right in there by the president, and all the Jews are around him, and they're all working, and they are contriving huge disasters and huge things, which the common American would never even be able to guess at. And no doubt they do this everywhere. They are old hands at playing the game. And then when the war is over and Roosevelt is later gone and so forth, the Jews also leave and disappear and they're gone. But for a period of time, when it's tactically and strategically critical for Jewry, they can reach in and take control of those levers of power for a period of time, do their dirty deeds, and then later they all disappear. 10 and 15 years later, they're gone. And then the normal white Americans end up taking control back of what used to be their government without even realizing that jury put its hand right in there, did a whole bunch of fiddling, caused huge problems, and then when jury is satisfied that the job is done, jury is gone again. So jury doesn't have to have people everywhere all the time. They can focus on a particular situation and start seeing how they can do things. The same happens in Britain, where the Jews go to Winston Churchill and then they start setting up everything so that they can finance him and handle him, and off he goes. And they help him to get into power. They see to it that he's got money. They see to it that he's got all the stuff he needs, and off they go. And when the war is over, things are finished, the Jews don't need Winston Churchill anymore, and they can move on and they can go and cause trouble somewhere else. Because I think you should see certain Jewish power as not being permanent. It is quite tactical sometimes. Some of it lasts longer than others, but not all of it is full power all the time. So let's continue. So it ended there by saying, a subterranean subversive wire pulling by the bloody Judah's hands can be clearly seen in this bill. Then the next one is, the popular French journalist Robert Valéry Radeau declares in the paper Ami du People on December 28, 1935. This is what a French journalist wrote. If the nations do not revolt against the abominable Masonic communist conspiracy, then in big capital letters it says, that means European war. So here is another guy who is trying to warn people. The French journalist Robert Valéry Radeau, on 28 December 1935, he wrote, if the nations do not revolt against the abominable Masonic communist conspiracy, that means European war. So he says Masonic communist, but we know also that communist is Jew. So he's also trying to say, rebel against the Jews or there's going to be another European war. Isn't it fantastic how many of these things were written years before the actual shooting started? Then the next paragraph says, all political developments of the last months point clearly to the fact that Jewry is driving for war. Let's recall once more the hair-raising admission of the Jew Marcus Eli Ravage made in February 1928 in the Century magazine. And the quote is, "We, Jews, are at the bottom not merely of the latest great war, but nearly all your wars." We, Jews, are at the bottom not merely of the latest great war, but nearly all your wars. So it ends with, "Gentiles, sound the alarm. Expose the conspiracy to bleed white Aryan Christian nations one against the other. Organize and fight Jewish communism, socialism, and all other protocolic creatures of hell." And then right at the very bottom in big capitals, they put there, "Keep Roosevelt and his Jews away from Washington. Eliminate the Jew from our national life. Vote and buy Gentile." Isn't that fabulous? So let's just reread some of that again. Just fabulous. "Gentiles, sound the alarm. Expose the conspiracy to bleed white Aryan Christian nations against one another. Organize and fight Jewish communism, socialism, and all other protocolic creatures of hell." And in big capitals, the rest of it, "Keep Roosevelt and his Jews away from Washington. Eliminate the Jew from our national life. Vote and buy Gentile." Isn't that wonderful? All these people, especially these Russian guys, are trying their damnedest to save people's lives and to save Europe from huge disaster. So there you can see that in 1935, here you've got a white guy, a good Freemason, coming out and telling people. You've got all different whites starting to pass word around. You've got the French, you've got the Belgians, you've got the British, you've got the Czechoslovakians, you got the Russians. Everyone is trying to save the Western world from a huge disaster, from a huge bloodletting. And here it is in writing. I just want to briefly show you a couple of other items out of the same issue of the American Gentile. This thing was jam-packed with stuff warning people and showing that they knew what was going on. On the screen in front of you, you'll see you should be able to make out the title of another little article. It says, At last, communism openly denounced as Jewish at the Kirby Talmadge Convention at Macon, Georgia. So listen to this. Now, nowadays, if you go to a conservative or even a liberal or anyone and you say to them, communism is Jewish, they'll tell you, no, that's bollocks, that's rubbish. And I myself, when I was initially digging into Hitler and communism, I tried the angle. I heard these hints that communism is Jewish. But if you go and you check in all the accepted information out there, you'll see that nobody admits that. They will not admit it at all. So here it is where these guys admit it. But the point here is that here we are almost 100 years later, and Jews have managed to kill this, and it is only National Socialists and people in the white right who even believe in this stuff. But the data is there from the past, but it's been discredited by Jewry, etc. You will even struggle to prove that Karl Marx was a Jew, etc. It's stuff that I looked at in the past, and it's very difficult. And you'll battle to convert certain people. So anyway, let's read this quickly. "The dam cunningly erected by Jewry to prevent any free discussion of Jewish subversive activities seems to be crumbling and giving way to rising adverse public sentiment." Just that little piece there. Isn't that like today with the internet? And one thing I gotta warn people about, just because we're making progress, don't think that soon there'll come a time where we'll sit and we'll be bored and we'll have nothing to do. You don't understand Jewry. Jewry will hide and lie and so forth. and we will have our hands full proving things that we know, proving things that we've seen, which jury then takes away. Jews will invent new lies, etc. These people are well practiced at this game of bullshit. So, you know, there it starts with, you know, the Jews erected this cunning dam, but it's crumbling and giving way to rising adverse public sentiment. Well, you know, go a decade or two after that, you know, go to the 1950s, 1960s, and all of that stuff is forgotten. The only guy who's then pointing out that communism is Jewish are guys like George Lincoln Rockwell. Other than that, these things disappear. So, you know, be aware that this struggle never actually ends. Whites are going to have to fight this battle literally with every generation. So let's just continue. The first breach so far as open discussion in a bona fide public meeting is concerned occurred in Macon, Georgia, at the time of the Kirby Talmadge Convention. This fact is of historical importance, as undoubtedly others will follow. A leading uncontrolled news service of Washington, D.C., comments in its report on this occasion as follows. The convention will go down in American history, not only because it expressed the clearest patriotic protests against the Roosevelt Frankfurter administration, but also for the reason that the delegates had the bravery to denounce the plotting of communist Jews and their bribed political fronts. The convention was the first important public meeting which displayed sufficient courage to violate the most nearly complete and damnable censorship ever organized over all channels of communication. So how's that? This convention was the first important public meeting which displayed sufficient courage to violate the most nearly complete and damnable censorship ever organized over all channels of communication. Well, fast forward to the 2020s, and Jewry has been engaging in the greatest censorship campaign in the history of the world. Back in 2020 or so, I was pointing out the insane censorship on YouTube, etc. And Jewry has been everywhere. They've been moving in on everything. So here we are, literally 100 years later, going through exactly the same game. The whites are desperately trying to get the message out. Jewry is busy shutting everything down. And these whites are thinking, we got it, we got it. We're going to make it, we're going to make it. But you and I know how history turns out. So it should show you that you are stuck in a rut with these bastards. Let's continue. The Jewish-owned or controlled American great press at this time found it impossible to conceal this fact, and naturally, as was to be expected, epithets of the kind of Hitlerite democracy, Ku Klux Klan tactics, etc., etc., were showered at the Southwestern Convention. As a most typical article of the Jewish press in reaction to this convention is the article in the Washington Post, Washington, D.C., of which we quote the following. There is no doubt that those seeking to lead Southern rebellion against President Roosevelt have decided to make the Negro an innocent football of their plans, just as the religious issue was raised in 1928. Their attacks are directed also against the Jew and whoever has a name that is not Anglo-Saxon. Moreover, it is not a whispering campaign. There is little subterfuge about it. The campaign is carried on boldly and brazenly from the public platform in open daylight. Thanks God the start is made. Let's hope that soon all the nefarious crimes of this race will be exposed in the open daylight to the people of America. That last part, thanks God the start is made. That is the Russians commenting on the Jewish bullshit. And then below it, they say, let's hope that soon all the nefarious crimes of this race will be exposed in the open daylight to the people of America, written 90 years ago. And here we are, almost a century later, running through exactly the same thing. On the bottom of that article, they have a nice little sort of advert that says, boycott slave-made goods of Jewish Soviet Union. How cool is that? Here is another article that I want to read a chunk of, also from exactly the same American Gentile. You should be able to make out the title, which says March of Jewish Events. So it says, all this happens in the space of hardly 2 years. Behind the scenes of artificially created, quotes, public opinion. Listen to this. Here they talk about how Freemasonry is busy killing people. But remember now, Freemasonry is functioning on the orders of Jewry. Freemasonry is killing kings in Europe. Listen to this. Our correspondent, Mann, in Zurich, writes to us under date of December 20th. Since the rise to power of National Socialism in Germany, people in other countries are beginning more and more to realize the danger of the secret powers of Jewry and Freemasonry. So, as the Germans are coming to power, no doubt the broadcasts and speeches from Germany are waking huge numbers of people up. They are hearing all this talk about Jews and Freemasonry and blah, blah, blah. And people are waking up. However, listen to this. In the year 1933, that's the year when Hitler came to power, nothing extraordinary occurred in the political sphere, as the general opinion in supranational circles was that National Socialism would only last a few months at the most. So, let's just reread that. Very important point. As the general opinion in supranational circles was that National Socialism would only last a few months at the most. So everyone reckoned this idiot Hitler, he's gonna be flopping out in no time at all. However, see what happens. As this hope steadily vanished, fierce war propaganda against National Socialist Germany was started. So the moment that they could see Hitler's not collapsing, he's solving problems, he's moving on, look at what happens. Fierce war propaganda against Germany starts. But it gets even creepier. Listen to this. The French government then formed, manifestly under the influence of Freemasonry, which has a direct stranglehold on this country and largely against the will of the French nation itself, a military alliance with the Jewish rulers of the Soviet Union, beginning thus the encircling of Germany. Remember previously the whole story about a ring of iron around Germany and Italy? So France under Freemasonry is teaming up with Russia, and they're going to be on the different sides of Germany. By the way, remember all these things, because whenever you read or hear about World War II, you will constantly be told, oh, Hitler went out to conquer everyone. No, Jewry is setting up enemies all around Germany and Italy, so that Germany and Italy can't do anything, especially Germany, so that every single country on every single side is able to block Germany and stop things. Keep this in mind when you hear later people speaking about, oh, Hitler, look at what he went and did when he invaded Norway, and then Hitler invaded, you know, Poland and so forth. In every single case, you will find that Hitler had no option. that if Hitler did not do those things, they would have had Germany in a position where Germany would not be able to function, like stopping the steel from Sweden getting to Germany, etc. These bastards, here, as you can read in 1936, these bastards are already at work to collapse Hitler, and he's hardly even got going. And then the other thing that's mentioned here is that the French government was formed under the influence of Freemasonry. Something that they never mention, which I've come across, is that the French had a prime minister called Leon Blum, and he was Jewish. He's not a guy that you hear much about, but he is very active, actually, that French prime minister. He plays a role in the French helping communism in Spain. I'll just give you a little summary quickly. The Spanish Civil War began in July 1936. Just a few months after Blum's Popular Front government came to power in France. The Spanish Republican government, that is the communists, are under attack from Franco. But Franco is backed by Hitler and Mussolini. So Blum, who is also a, quotes, socialist, probably read into that communist, Blum was also trying to get the French to help the communists in Spain. And the French right wing actually accused Blum of plotting a, quotes, red Europe. In other words, communist Europe. So Blum is actually a guy you don't hear much about, but I thought I'd just mention that. But let me carry on reading because this thing gets bizarre. Let's continue. In February 1934, we have the first unusual occurrence in the puzzling and already prophesied death of the unfortunate King Albert of Belgium. It was a known fact that this sovereign was opposed to being driven with his people into another war with Germany. It was not a German National Socialist, but the English Colonel Graham Seton Hutchinson, who in his well-known book, Your Verdict, accused Freemasonry of having brought about with violence the death of the King of Belgium. Shortly afterwards, the Belgian Foreign Minister, Count de Broqueville, too, was overthrown and replaced by the Jew, Heymans. The Count had, after the death of King Albert, stood up valiantly for peace. The peace-loving Belgian staff chief, Nathan, was also dispatched. So they killed the Belgian king. They managed to get a count tossed out of his job and replaced by a Jew. And they managed to get rid of another guy, the Belgian staff chief, or probably chief of staff. But that's not all. Listen to this. A further unusual event was the assassination at Marseille in the beginning of October 1934, in which the unfortunate King Alexander of Yugoslavia lost his life. Of Alexander, it was known that he, like the Belgian King Albert, was a real lover of peace and unfavorable to any war policy. Not a German socialist, but a French author, Robert Henri Petit, or Petit, charges Freemasonry with the guilt of this act too. He affirms that the murder of Alexander had been decided upon by Freemasonry because the king had definitely refused to enter into diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union. So the Belgian king is killed. The king of Yugoslavia is killed. Then in the Soviet Union, something bizarre happens. Even in the Soviet Union, however, an unusual occurrence was to take place. The class-conscious communist proletarian was no doubt considerably surprised to read in the papers one fine day that of all people, the Jew Radek Sobelson had been instructed by the Kremlin to revive Freemasonry in the Soviet Union, and that under his patronage, 6 Masonic lodges had been set up in the most important Russian cities. The class-conscious communist workman for whom Freemasonry is purely an institution of the bourgeoisie will of course never grasp the fact that in view of the tense situation in Europe, it is of the greatest importance to the lodges to attain to a position of power in the Jewish Soviet Union too. So then they write, what political assassinations will in future be plotted in the Jewish lodges of the Soviet Union? So who are they still going to kill in the Soviet Union? So it's fascinating that here they see Freemasonry as playing an important role in killing people. That to me is something new. Then they've got a long story, which I'm not going to read. It's to do with Turkey, and it's about the president of Turkey was himself a Freemason. But then later he realizes that the Freemasons are going to get rid of him. So then he makes moves of his own against them. But what these guys are pointing out is that weird things are happening in Europe, and all this stuff is starting about a year after Hitler's come to power. Now that they see that Hitler's not just a buffoon and he's surviving, that now they start killing people. And it's not even German National Socialists who are pointing it out. It's a British army officer. It's another Frenchman. People are seeing, what the heck is going on here? Why are these guys dropping down dead? So these things should give you a much clearer idea that World War II was very manufactured. I myself have read about JFK's father, because JFK's father was the ambassador to England, and he was privy to lots of the machinations that were going on between America and Britain with Poland, to get Poland to start making trouble with Germany, etc. So if you really look at this picture, it gives you a whole different picture of World War II. It's not like, oh, Hitler did this and Hitler did that. No, it's Hitler was minding his own business. He was just giving his speeches, telling people about Jews and Freemasons. But otherwise, Hitler wasn't doing anything. He was working in Germany, sorting things out. Germany was not collapsing. They were surviving despite everything. Meanwhile, Jewry has got everybody else on the move. It's got America on the move. It's got Britain on the move. It's got France on the move. It's got the Soviet Union on the move. They are killing people in Belgium. They're killing the king of Yugoslavia. Jewry is at work freaking everywhere, trying to surround Hitler and also trying to kill and get rid of anybody who is in favor of peace with Germany. This should give you a whole different view of how the hell World War II actually started. And this is just from this one particular issue of the American Gentile. And I've looked through other issues, and I want to tell you that there is a lot of news that I was looking at that is forgotten today. There was a hell of a lot going on, and the whites of that time in Europe, the Germans themselves and others, were seeing and spotting a lot of stuff. There was a lot going on. World War II is a totally manufactured thing. Totally manufactured. Jewry was hard at work. Let me read the last article in this issue. because in here, you're going to see yet another angle. And the angle is that Jewry, once it had gotten control of Russia, of the Soviet Union, that Jewry immediately wanted to destroy Europe. This is something I've not really mentioned in detail, but you will find that after the Soviet Union, that literally all across the world, literally all across the Western world, there were communist parties springing up in every country, trying to overthrow every single country. There were communists in South Africa. Whites were killing each other. I'm not joking with you. Whites were killing each other here in Johannesburg, fighting, in brutal fighting, right here in Johannesburg where I live, in the early 1920s. But all across Europe, there were communist parties jumping up everywhere. And you'll even find there was a communist party in Canada. There's a communist party in America. Communist parties were coming up everywhere. Jewry was going after the whole Western world. In fact, Jewry was going after the whole world. They wanted to conquer the whole world. But inside Europe, there were brutal communist revolutions inside Europe. And Germany, it was hoped, would be one of their key countries that the communists were going to capture. But they failed. The Germans managed to get out of the trap. In the same way that today, Jewry has planned our demise, okay, everywhere. Jewry has planned our demise in different countries. I've not even told you the story about what they planned for South Africa. But the Germans managed to get out of that trap. And all whites can still get out of the traps that Jewry has laid. So let me read this because this is pretty interesting. It's called Germany's Problem. And you can see it on the screen there. Oh, and by the way, these guys were selling the protocols of the Elders of Zion. They were doing everything they could. So under the title Germany's Problem, they write, "Ever since the destruction of the Tsar's government, Moscow has worked through the arteries of international Jewry to bring about the collapse of all the countries of Europe. International Jewry to bring about the collapse of all the countries of Europe. For years, they concentrated their efforts upon Germany. It looked for a time as though they would succeed. Had the Germans gone down, communism would have swept everything as far west as the English Channel before this time. By 1919, the Reds felt certain Germany had become so weakened by strikes, mob violence, and class hatreds, all of which were started by Jews, by the way, that the country was ready to be annexed as a member of Soviet Socialist Republics, part of the USSR. In April of that year, a group of Jews headed by Karl Radek and Kurt Eisner set up a branch of the Moscow government in the city of Munich. They had their own private army and a system of dictatorship called the Revolutionary Tribunal. Prior to that time, hundreds of lives were taken in riots and street fights. Millions of dollars worth of property was destroyed. Behind all of these revolutionary outbreaks, there was an organization of Jews, which included such leaders as Rosa Luxemburg, Karl Liebknecht, Gustav Landauer, Ernst Thaler, Oscar Cohen, Kurt Musam, and others. I have read some of that history myself, and I got to tell you that the Jewish hag, Rosa Luxemburg, for example, the way that she used to talk was exactly the same way that Julius Malema talks in South Africa now. I'm not joking with you. All of this stuff has been done before. And they were working to get Germans to kill each other. That is what they did. The Germans later killed Rosa Luxemburg. That was an awesome thing. Let's continue. Some of the ringleaders were lawyers of the type of Hans Litten, who, like the Civil Liberties Union in the United States, specialized in providing legal service to communists who were found guilty of carrying on subversive activities. So there's a wake up for Americans. Civil Liberties Union, CLU, clearly just a Jewish front for being able to do other nefarious crap in your country. You probably know it, but it's worth mentioning. An example of how this new government went about its task of gaining control of Germany is illustrated by the Leitpold Gymnasium murder, in which 10 innocent hostages were shot down in cold blood to put terror into the hearts of the people of Munich. So you've got Jewish communist terrorism in Munich. Finally, Germany, with its 40 million Protestants and 20 million Catholics, revolted. With one smashing blow, they broke the chains that had been so efficiently forged about them. In this, they demonstrated greater resistance than the people of Russia. During this entire period of uncertainty, when Germany came so near the brink of destruction, the Jewish population numbered only about 1% of the country's total. So 1% of the population is Jews, and they are setting the country on fire. That percentage, I will revisit that percentage, because elsewhere I found that when the percentage of Jews is 5%, when it's 5%, people can't take it anymore. So in the USA now, with 7.5 million Jews, Jews make up 2.4% of the population. 1% of Jews in Germany was already setting Germany on fire. Let's continue. But it was this powerful minority that controlled the press, the stage, the motion picture industry, the magazine publishing houses, the radio, and the channels of finance. So Jewry in Germany controlled all the media and the money. And then they can set the country on fire. The newspapers of the United States published daily reports designed to create prejudice against Germany. Now listen to this, but it should be remembered that according to authoritative sources, no less than 60% of the 400 employees in the New York offices of the Associated Press are Jews. So they are saying that 60% of the employees in the New York offices of the Associated Press, 60% of those employees are Jews. 60% of the 400 are Jews. So the Jews are crawling all over the media. Let's continue. Moreover, the official representative of the Associated Press in Berlin, Mr. Louis P. Lochner, has a past record as being a radical socialist and communist for many years. So when they can't put a Jew in there, they toss in a white communist. In 1919, he helped organize the Soviet Federated Press of Europe. These disclosures will serve to illustrate the manner in which pernicious forces have been able to bore into news-gathering agencies. Beyond question, the Associated Press is the most powerful factor in the United States for molding public sentiment. In the light of these revelations, one may now understand why such Jews as Litvinov, Radek, and other members of the Moscow dictatorship are always referred to as, quotes, Russians in the newspapers, and why Jewish criminals like Dutch Schultz are called Germans, and why the Jew Isidore Fisch, who many believe actually killed the Lindbergh baby, is described in Associated Press dispatches as the little German furrier. So there's quite a story for you, hey? Where they describe the trouble the Jews caused in Germany, and also how all of these things are covered up. Jews hide the fact that other Jews are big troublemakers in other countries because they control the press, they control basically everything. So whites are basically herded like sheep or cattle to the slaughter. But these articles, this is what these Russians were writing in 1936, as they were trying to warn everybody of what the Jew rat scum are busy doing to set Europe and the world on fire, to get rid of national socialism in Germany, which is not collapsing as they thought it would. So if you'll take a look on the screen in front of you, there's a little screenshot of what those guys were putting in their newsletter. There in 1936, they were saying, let's take America away from the Jews. Vote and buy Gentile. These guys were really trying their best. I think that these two Russian military officers did a magnificent job of trying to warn Americans and trying to spread the truth about the rotten Jew scum. But what is clear is that Hitler rising and taking power in Germany, and Hitler and Goebbels with their speeches and their news reports, they were waking up the entire world to the dangers of the rotten Jews and Freemasonry. They were waking up the whole freaking world. There are other things that I've spotted as well in the past, like when Hitler changed laws and did certain things with certain laws. Other countries in Europe were starting to copy some of the things Hitler was doing. For Jewry, Hitler is the greatest nightmare in all of their existence. For Jewry, Hitler, as well as National Socialism, Hitler is first and foremost waking everybody up. The longer Hitler stays in power, the more it means Jewry is going to be destroyed. That if Hitler stays in power for 5 years, 10 years, if the Nazis continue for 15 and 20 years, Jewry will be destroyed worldwide. As other people start looking at Germany, seeing the successes, learning from Germany, and following the German way. So for Jewry, this country that they'd hoped to turn into a communist rat hole, which despite all of their tricks, they failed to do, they then realized that they got to get literally the whole world to gang up on these people. Because if those people win in that one country, the entire Western civilization is going to change. The whole of the world is going to change. Everyone's going to learn from Hitler. And when people see Germany as a success, everyone's going to start getting ideas from that and following in their footsteps. For Jewry, the rise of Hitler is literally a death sentence for them. And they see it. And when they realize that Hitler's not a buffoon, he's rocking and rolling, this system's going to stay, they lose their minds and they go berserk. They've got to get rid of that man and that country. If they don't do it, the entire world, and most definitely Western civilization, is all going to change. In Britain, you got a guy like Mosley. All across the Western world, there are fascists coming into existence. Even in South Africa, among the Boers, there's the Ossewar Brandwach. There's also an organization in South Africa known as the Grey Shirts. All across the Western world, people are listening to Hitler, listening to Goebbels, watching the Germans, and people are already changing. So for Jewry, Jewry knows their clock is ticking, their time is up. If they don't do something, their stupid plans for world conquest are failing. That man and those people in Germany are going to totally overturn everything that Jewry has been up to. And Jews lose their minds, they go crazy, they've got to start a war, they've got to do things to drive people away from what Hitler is saying and what the Germans are doing. Because the Jews know that this is a death sentence for them. They know it. They can see that they tried to control and destroy those people because those people are indestructible. And there are many other ways to confirm that all of World War II was a setup. You've got John F. Kennedy's father, and then there are the bizarre moves of the Soviets against Finland, the British against Norway, because for the Soviets, they probably thought that Finland is a small white nation, they can quickly overrun them, and then they can get to Sweden. Sweden is where the metal is. Sweden is where Germany gets all its iron from. But then the Finns proved to be such a tough, rugged little nation that stupid plan of theirs didn't work, and this little tiny nation actually stopped the whole Soviet army. So they then couldn't get to Sweden. But you can see how this thing is a conspiracy of everybody against Germany. So nowadays, when you hear all this junk history, oh, Hitler, he set out to conquer everyone. No, no, no. Jury set out to conquer everybody. It was Jury that was meddling in every damned country. Jury was lighting fires all over the place. And when they got something working in one place, then they light a fire in another place. They burned down Russia. Now they want to burn down Germany. They're also busy burning down Hungary and other countries. Mussolini was fighting communists. Franco was fighting communists. It's Jury that are the big troublemakers, and Jury is setting the world on fire. However, a lot of the Jewish plans do not really work. And they are fumbling, bumbling plans. And when the whites in a country are tougher and they are more organized, those whites are able to escape, like the Italians and the Germans did, and later the Spanish. But the big troublemakers who stoke in every damn fire all over the place, who are engaging in massive social experiments and herding whites like freaking cattle and sheep to the slaughter. It's Jewry. Jews are the big troublemakers. And it's not Nazis busy killing the King of Belgium. It's Jewish Freemasonry killing the Belgian king, the King of Yugoslavia, etc. The Jews are moving forward through assassination and murder. And in the Soviet Union, where they are already killing people, they are still setting up new Freemason lodges for new stuff. These secret societies are nasty. This is the first time that I've ever come across such mention of Freemasonry busy killing people. And of course, now that Freemasonry is owned by Jews since 1874, you know, now you've got a big problem. So poor old Hitler, all he was trying to do was just save Germany. That's all he was trying to do. And he is blamed for everything. And it's all bullshit, all just total bullshit. And you can examine it from every conceivable angle. He wasn't the troublemaker. He didn't kill anyone outside his country. But Jury is flipping all over the show, killing people, organizing this country to go and fight that country, this thing to do that thing. It's insane. It's insane what the Jews were getting up to. But there are other things that also show that Jews had foreknowledge of what was coming. And you'll see that in other videos, that Jury knew that the killing was coming, because they're the ones organizing all the killing that's going to take place. But they don't want to be killed themselves. So this should give you an idea that years before the first shots were ever even fired in World War II, Jury was not only planning these wars, Jury was already busy killing people and messing with Europe in order to set Europe up for the bloodletting that they need in order to get rid of Adolf Hitler and the National Socialists. And here we are, almost 100 years later, and Jury is still wildly out of control. Thank you very much for listening today. I hope that you learned something new today. Look after yourselves and take care. We'll be chatting again soon. We'll be right back.
give up, my friend. If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you will. Every fight you fight,